Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I am Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Monday, September 18th, 2023. Thank you for tuning in to WVW-TV and the Eastman Financial Report. It's always a pleasure to be able to spend a half hour with you and try to shed some light on the current economic news. And there's always plenty of news to be shedding light on. Anyway, thank you so much for tuning in. And I also like to thank our sponsor, Swiss America Trading, which is, as I like to say, a fine purveyor of precious metals. It's an American company based in Arizona, and they've been making a market in tangible precious metals for quite some time. So if you're looking for somebody to work with in that space, if you're thinking about expanding your portfolio and to include precious metals, certainly give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, SwissAmerica.com, and use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, and they'll be happy to send you some free information. Matter of fact, right now, if you know what they say, every dark cloud has a silver lining, and today I can prove that. I'm happy to announce that Swiss America is offering a spectacular deal on silver walking Liberty half dollars, which are silver bullion coins, and they're selling them amazingly at $13.50 each. That's including the price of delivery. And that's a really great deal. If you look at the value of silver and the fact that, you know, bullion coins are a tremendous way to invest in tangibles, this is a great deal. So if you're really interested in expanding your silver or gold holdings, take advantage of this offer from Swiss America. It's a fantastic price, $13.50 each delivered. Give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. They'll be happy to explain the program and take your order. But this deal won't last forever. Of course, it's always depending on the price of silver. But this is a spectacular deal. And, I think there's a cap of 250 coins per person, so you don't want to miss out. This is only available until their inventory is gone. So if you're sitting on the fence and thinking about buying some extra silver at $13.50, this would be probably a good day to pick up the phone, give them a call, or go to the website, use the promo code Eastman and tell them Dan Eastman sent you. So give them a call on that. Certainly a really great opportunity to save yourself some money and convert some Federal Reserve notes into tangible value assets. Let's talk about the news this week. It's a busy week, of course. We've got the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting tomorrow, the 19th, and Wednesday, the 20th. And of course, they meet periodically to decide how to fiddle around with the interest rates in an attempt to control the economy. And of course, the Federal Open Market Committee is comprised, as we know, of the seven members of the Board of Governors, who are all appointed by the president to 15-year terms and confirmed by the Senate. And then we have the president of the New York Central Bank, New York Federal Reserve Bank, and then also four of the 11 regional banks. So there's 12 of them at all, and 12 of them at all. And of course, they'll all be sitting around for 2 days trying to figure out what they're going to do with the economy. Now let's think about that for just a minute. What you're seeing, and there's no magic lever. They don't meet in a secret temple somewhere. There's a big lever in the middle, and they pull it. That none of that happens. What they're doing is they sit around and they're debating whether or not to play with the interest rates, and should they lower the interest rates to stimulate the economy? Because we're seeing a lot of bad news about the economy. It is not in good shape. If you're a lower income American, you're not in a good position right now. And that's all because the interest rates have gone from 2.5% to 7.5% mortgage rates, and they've cranked the rates. So the Federal Reserve has to think about that. I mean, what they're trying to do is tame inflation, which is hardest on the poor, by slamming the poor the hardest. So it's kind of a counterintuitive situation. And one of the problems, of course, that the Federal Reserve has is that, as I explained last week, The economy itself is a free market. Whether you like it or not, there's a global economy, and that's businesses and individuals who interact. And governments have always tried to step into that because they like to control things. The centrally planned communist economies back in the day, you know, the Soviet Union was supposed to be a model of every last item in the economy was centrally planned and programmed by bureaucrats, and everybody had a place to be. And after 70 years, the whole thing fell apart because the reality is people are individuals and they consume according to their needs, okay? And of course, according to their means, you know, if you have enough money for a a small fuel efficient car, or you have a money for Rolls Royce. It's your choice. Okay. So you have this big economy, and it's humming along. And one of the factors in an economy, of course, is debt. And I want to talk a little bit about debt today, because my next story is going to be about the federal government and that. Debt is an issue. And of course, if there was no such thing as debt, if you had to have money and then you exchange money, I guess we'll go back to the caveman days when they first invented money, and basically people were starting to specialize specialties in their jobs. You were in an economy that did not have debt, and that's been through most of American history, of course, as well as the world history, that most people didn't have access to debt, because debt was thought of as a separate and special power. The concept of leveraging comes in. The reason you have debt is because you want to borrow money from your future earnings and spend it today to make your life better today. Okay, and that's really from a consumer perspective. That's what debt is. And if you go back throughout American history, and I remember the 1960s and 1970s very clearly, that the individual, the working person, didn't have access to a lot of debt. And if you did have access, you'd have to have collateral that would equal the debt. It was very hard for people to borrow money. And most people, the working class people of America, farmers would lose their farms left and right borrowing from the bank, but urban people, they did not have access to debt. And of course, that meant that if they wanted to buy something, they'd have to save up their money and buy it, or have it in their paychecks. People tended to pay with cash, or maybe on the checking account you could write a check. But I remember back in the day, there was actually a fee. Every time you wrote a paper check, your bank would charge you 10 cents as a processing fee. It was basically a world where people spent the money they had. They earned the money and they spent it. And when you didn't have money, you didn't spend money. It was just accepted in our culture that if you don't have money, you don't buy something, because you don't have the money. You can't steal it. You have to have the money to pay for it. So when consumer debt happened in the late 1960s, early into the 1970s, it became a thing, and it became a very damaging thing to society. We all know that, Tennessee Ernie Ford and his famous song about the, I sold my soul to the company store. When people would have access to credit, especially working class people, it was very, very difficult to buy food or clothing or something on credit. And then when that next pay cycle came along, there were demands, current instant demands for the pay. You were not in a position to be able to take this week's pay and pay off last week's spending and then have money for groceries. So you got into a very vicious debt cycle, that if they gave you debt, they could trap you in a cycle where you had to make the next paycheck to pay last week's spending, and next week's spending was more credit. And you see this in certain industries today, in the inner city and urban areas. There are businesses that are established I'm not going to go into detail, but people who live there know what I'm talking about, that you get trapped in where next week's paycheck is paying off last week's debt at very high interest rates, and you can never break out of the cycle unless you can find a second job or a side hustle or whatever. Or win the lottery or whatever, you're trapped in debt. And debt is a very powerful thing, because what it does is it allows you to have things today that you probably shouldn't have, because you don't have the money to have it. But you get that instant gratification, and then the idea is, well, I'll pay it off later. And later never comes. And I think that's a real part of the problem with the American psyche today. As I'm reading through all of these news stories, they're kind of sad and depressing, because they talk about American citizens, we the people, as consumers. We're locked into this title this class, the social class of consumers. And I was reading a story in a very prominent financial newspaper this morning that there was an article discussing that the current situation is impacting the lowest income people much more than the higher income people, because they are obviously they have lower income, and we're seeing much higher gas prices at the pumps. We're seeing at this time of year, after the great summer rush of summer vacations and driving around, miles tend to decline, and gasoline demand somewhat declines because kids go back to school, people stop traveling, back to work, and what we're seeing is that gasoline prices are simply not dropping like they used to drop and fall after the demand. And this, of course, is having a disproportionate impact on lower income people, along with food inflation. If you remember, core inflation is general inflation minus food and energy. Well, we're looking at health insurance bills going to be going up. This is the time of year where it's open season or open book or whatever they call it, where you sign up for next year's health insurance plan. And if you are employed, you're going to be paying, I think there was an average of like 6.5% higher premiums on average. And if you're in the health exchange program, those premiums go up just as well. So you're starting to see food inflation, you're starting to see transportation inflation, and you're starting to see healthcare premium inflation. And of course, your deductibles are always there every year. They kick back in, you know, it's not like you pay and you're done once. It's every year, there's your share. And of course, when you go into a medical facility, you have no clue what they're charging. There's no menu. You say, oh, I think I'll take this service, and that service seems a little high. Now you go in, you get your treatment, you come home, and you get this whopper bill. There it is. And it's not, you know, it's not covered because you haven't met your deductible. So all of this stuff plays havoc with the lower income Americans. And when you add this concept of consumer credit, credit cards, basically, car loans, but need a car with credit. The interesting thing about that article was it was talking about how these consumers are holding up, that the lowest income people are still holding up, they're still spending money. But then when you read through the article, it became quite obvious that they're using credit cards. And when you're buying things on credit cards, paying 18% or maybe 29%, whatever your rate is, you're not improving your position. You're digging yourself deeper in the hole. You still need the food. You still need the clothing. You still need whatever it is you put on your credit card. But the impact of these higher interest rates on lower income Americans is pronounced. So the question that I ask these federal policy people is, you're trying to fight inflation by killing the very people that are financially disadvantaging, the very people you're trying to protect. If remember my three silos, you have the poor people, the people in the middle, and the rich, if you care less. Well, if you're so worried about the poor and inflation hurting the poor, you're squeezing the inflation out of the economy by squeezing the poor and adding to their debt. And debt is an inflationary concept, because if you go back to the Milton Friedman theories of monetary economics and the velocity of money, that every time you open up a new charge card, that's new money. It creates new money. So, well, no, it doesn't. You got to pay it back. And I remember when I was working on my master's degree, we had a very, very wonderful professor at the UW-Milwaukee who was a monetary theory guy. He studied under Milton Friedman, and God rest his soul, he's going to his great reward now. But I always admired his mind. And he and I got into a bit of a discussion. It was friendly, you know, student and professor. But I was arguing from the perspective of a young student, because credit cards had just come into vogue. Students back in the 70s, you didn't get a credit card. Nobody would give a student a credit card. Well, they started coming in because the credit card company saw this as a great pool of business expansion to get 18 to 29% interest from young people who want everything. That's why we have massive student loans today. But anyway, my argument with Walt was effectively that when you look at the supply of money, M1 and M2 being pumped into the economy, the more money that the Fed would pump in, it would create a velocity, more money chasing same goods, it would create a velocity that propels the economy forward and triggers inflation. And my argument was, when you add consumer debt, it's like the Fed throwing just helicopter money into the economy. It's just an ocean of new money. And then Walt would say, no, you have to pay that back. And as a young student, pay that back. I'm going to run these revolving credit bills until I drop dead. And my, you know, the life insurance can pay that off at the end, you know. And I was right. I was prescient because as a young consumer who's also a grad student looking at this, you know, they mail you a credit card with $5,000 of credit. And you think, hey, I got $5,000 to spend. You don't think about the debt burden coming down the path. Well, now, as a wise old man, I do. I think, oh, that was bad. Because basically what you did is you took all the millions, hundreds of millions of Americans, 300 million Americans, whatever, and you give them credit cards, and they spend money they don't have. And the bank is pumping that out. So when you're trying to play games with the economy, remember this is a big ball of the economy going on, and the Federal Reserve is not trying to stimulate or contract for the purpose of a shrinking or growing economy. They're fighting an inflationary phenomenon. And unfortunately, I'm more and more convinced of late that the Federal Reserve is using the wrong tool to try and fight inflation. And I mentioned that last week with that article about our gasoline prices, a better regulator of the economy than monetary policy. And there's a good argument for that. I don't know if it's... There's a good argument for that, but the problem is when you raise gas prices to slow the economy, you can slow the economy two ways. Let's pretend two ways, okay? One is you increase the interest rates and business lending slows down. Consumer lending can't because people have to buy clothes and they have to buy food. And they're going to use the credit card because they're not going to run around naked starving. And now they're paying 29% instead of 23%. So you're burning the lowest of the low, okay? Because they have the money. You've got to use the credit card. So when you're jacking up the interest rates, all you're doing is hurting the companies who lay off the lowest workers first, and you're raising the interest costs of the lowest workers. And that's a long-term process when you raise interest rates in an economy. It's not instant. So maybe the better argument is gas goes to $7. The low-income people maybe take the bus or walk or ride a bicycle or do something to avoid that cost, but stay out of debt, and they're not paying 29% interest on gasoline to drive to work and then to the grocery store. Then this is how fiscal policy, or at least monetary policy, there's two kinds of policies. Fiscal policy, you know, how the government fiddles around the economy in its tax and spend and borrow and spend under the Keynesian model. And then there's monetary policy, which is playing games with the interest rates. I'm beginning to argue, or at least believe I should be arguing, that interest rate regulation of the economy is a fool's errand, because of the fact that we have 20 or 32, 33, 34 trillion dollars in outstanding federal debt, and the federal government pays interest on all of that debt. So when the Federal Reserve jacks up the interest rates and it trickles through the economy over time, all you're doing is creating a bigger and bigger and bigger nightmare for the federal government to deal with. You're hurting the poorest of the poor. The rich are making money like there's no tomorrow. When you start looking at the price of luxury real estate and what bonds are paying, if you have an extra pile of money laying around and you're in the stock market and the bond market, you're going to be doing really well in an inflationary environment. Your home is going to be going up. Your real estate investments, your second home, your third home, all that stuff's going up. And there's a strata of people around the globe. It's not just Americans living in a little bubble economy. You know, people in Europe and people in South America and in Asia, they're all making a lot of money. They're all bidding up the price of real estate. So the rich are getting richer and richer and richer. And this monetary policy is just burning the lower class, or the lower income people in America. Lower class, it's a bad word. It's lower income. You know, everybody's, you know, in a class, we're all people in a republic. We're all equal here. But it's got more to do with your earnings power than it does anything else. So this is the big problem the Fed is dealing with. And of course, they're going into the meeting tomorrow thinking, well, should we raise the rates and really try to squeeze this inflation out because we want to protect the poor? And the poor saying, don't raise the rates. I don't want to be paying 40% on my credit cards. I don't want my boss shutting down his business and laying me off. Just stop playing with the economy. You know, in the end, Adam Smith will be proven right. I hate to say it, you know, you get to the very end, and in the long run, everything's in equilibrium. And unfortunately, all of this need, political need for meddling to preserve political power, is creating quite a havoc in our economy. So as we watch the Federal Reserve, you know, we'll see what they do. But if they, you know, what they should be doing is cutting rates back to 2% and turning the fire on so that everybody can, you know, get back into the game. If you're not sitting with tangible assets right now, that's a disadvantage. Now, I know a lot of people could not possibly afford to call 1-800-519-6271 and spend $13.52 on a silver dollar. It just maybe is not in your budget. But I'm telling you, if you're watching this and you're looking at what's happening at the federal level, this is for the first time in American history, we are in third world banana republic territory with respect to not only our debt, but the whole political fiasco in Washington. This is a time for you to take action and protect your wealth, your buying power. And the only way you're going to do that is through diversifying your holdings into tangibles that go up in value as inflation goes up. So you need to be doing that homework and thinking about how do I protect myself? And there are multiple ways to do that, but you might want to be thinking sooner rather than later, because at some point, when you know, to give you an example, we're looking at the second big news story today, of course, is that the our federal government, you know, is once again on the brink of shutting down. Now, we were dealing with this in March. They're going to shut down. Okay, we dealt with it the year before. It always happens at Christmas time. Well, this time they went into March. Well, here we are, September. 6 months later, and they're shutting down again. And it's always about this federal spending. It's because they don't have a budget. They don't pass a budget bill that Congress and everybody has to live within a budget. And they spend money according to the budget. And of course, if there's not enough money for your program and it's not in the budget, then you get to go away angry because you don't have any money allocated. They are so far past that right now. And with all of the debt, we talked last week about $2 trillion in deficit spending in this fiscal year that's ending September 30th. And if they can't get continuing resolutions passed because they're constantly playing political games, then the government shuts down. Well, the government's not going to shut down. I can tell you right now, folks, on September 30th, at stroke of midnight, entering October 1st, the government will not shut down. But we're going to listen to 2 more weeks of this back and forth stuff, talking about, you know, they want to cut here, they want to cut there. It doesn't matter where they cut. When you look at federal spending, you take the IRS collections from the Internal Revenue Service is charged with collecting the taxes, and that's set by formula. You know, the tax rates. You take the number of people who earn money, and you figure out, you know, who all pays what bracket, and then there's this, you got to collect that, okay? And most of it gets collected, and it's a big pot of money, and then they spend VAT $2 trillion more than that. $2 trillion, and nobody knows what a trillion is. I told you, if I hand you a dollar bill every second, how long does it take me to hand you $1 trillion? It's like 56,800 years. It's a crazy number. It's crazy. So what we end up with at a time when we've got you know, more political crazy than anybody's ever remembered in Washington, what it tells you is that simply that system is broken and it needs to be fixed. And the question is, how do you fix it? And you say, well, we'll have to elect some new people. And I said, well, okay, you're going to elect some new people, but, you know, good luck. Let me know how that works out. I'll be talking, you know, 10 years from now, if I'm still doing this, I'll be talking about, you know, it's going to be 180 trillion in debt. So anyway, this is all wrapping together is what we have from an economy that's very, very frustrating. And I think, you know, maybe a call to your representative, your senator, saying, you know, at some point, and I know you're only one, you know, it's like 435 people in the United States House of Representatives, you know, they're all, you know, they're supposed to be equal, they're not supposed to get there, you know, they're not. They're just my guy, he might as well, you know, I don't know. But the point is, you might want to be calling and saying, we need fiscal discipline in the government. Our municipality has fiscal discipline, our county has fiscal discipline, our state certainly has fiscal discipline, and we expect that in Washington as well. And I think that it's important that people at least express some concern, because ultimately what happens is that when you look throughout history, if you read history, and I read a lot of economic history, which is about as boring a thing as you could possibly read, but there are trends that are consistent throughout time. And when people in power are reckless with spending the public fisc, and you know, they're afraid to tax the populi because the people will revolt. Nobody wants to be paying 98% of their income to the federal government and then watch what the federal government's doing with your money. I mean, it's just crazy. So they don't. They leave it, you know, at 35% tax rate or whatever the rates are. And, you know, they're nowhere near enough to pay for all the spending. So they borrow and they borrow and they borrow. And there's no mechanism to stop the federal borrowing. We had a debt ceiling. They suspended it. Now we're going to shut down. Not going to shut down. The point is that the government, at least with respect to the federal government of the United States, having this post-World War II aura of the most powerful superpower on the planet Earth, seems to be impervious to economic fact and economic reality. And at the end of the day, you simply cannot continue to spend more money than you take in for long periods of time without causing structural damage that effectively destabilizes the country. And, you know, when, remember back in the day when President Obama was elected, and he said, I want to fundamentally change America. Well, you know, one great way to do it is just to spend yourself broke. You want to fundamentally change your family, just spend yourself broke. Just rack up every credit card, you know, go take a lot of vacations, put, you know, all these intangibles like meals, rack up, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in meals and on your credit card, watch what happens to you, you know, and there won't be anybody there to bail you out because our federal government, you know, back in the day, we had our Constitution that was came into being back in the 1780s, 83. And one of the rights that Americans had was bankruptcy. And we always think of bankruptcy in a negative term, but bankruptcy was a right guaranteed by the Constitution. And there was a reason for that, because back in merry old England, among other places, if you owed somebody money, they could file a petition or a writ and have you incarcerated, throw you in jail until such time as you or your family paid off the money. And of course, if you didn't have a family willing to pay off your debt, you'd sit in jail the rest of your life. It was terrible. It was debtor's prison. And, you know, nobody wanted that. Everybody was terrified of it. So we had a constitutional article that said basically, all right, to file bankruptcy and a fresh start. You start over once every 7 years. And that was a very, very valuable and cherished right that Americans tended to not think about, because this whole concept of not paying your debt and going bankrupt is a negative. But this was a positive safeguard on the individual liberties. Well, of course, you know, fast forward to today, and through Congress and the presidents have signed bills that make it impossible to discharge student loans, make it impossible to discharge credit cards. Well, almost impossible. You have to be on your deathbed, basically. And more and more debt is less and less dischargeable. They'll put you on a plan, they'll restructure you, and you're going to go forward over a 4-year or 5-year period, and you're going to make the plan payments. And of course, there's relief, but it's not debt forgiveness. So that becomes a real problem as more and more Americans are being forced into higher debt for medical bills. And also low-income Americans who just simply can't pay rent, buy groceries, drive a car, go to work. They don't make enough money. The debt burden is getting bigger and bigger, and it's reflecting the national debt as well. Well, there will be a day, and I think as an Austrian economist, if I am such a thing, at least as a person who studied Austrian School of Economics, hard money and this idea of debt, there will be a reckoning, at least according to that theory. And that day of reckoning is a, you know, the visions of wheelbarrows full of dollar bills or Deutsche Marks to buy a loaf of bread. And if you look at Zimbabwe, you look at Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, you look at Venezuela, when you start thinking in terms of picking through garbage piles to find something of value or something to eat, that's when you're going to start to realize that our government, we, the people's representatives, we don't live in a democracy. We have a representative form of government, and we send our representatives to Washington. And I'm telling you, they get off the train and they go nuts. And here they are. The system, economic system, is simply unsustainable. And it's not going to play out well for the average person. So you want to be, you know, a step ahead of that. You want to be smart. And I strongly suggest you investigate the benefits of having the diversified portfolio scattered around with tangible and other assets that go up in value. Because if you don't, you know, And you think about, how does the dust settle? The dust always settles and something else emerges, but it's always a disaster. It's always a very turbulent thing. Well, anyway, sorry for the doom and gloom today, but I think it's something to consider when we're looking at our federal system, and just maybe time to call your congressman. Anyway, thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow. We'll see what the Fed's up to tomorrow. Have a great day. Bye.